Right?
Yeah, don't break it off.
Hey, good morning. So, if you want to take your Bibles, open up to the book of Haggai. The book of Haggai, it's one of the minor prophets in the Old Testament. And just a little bit of a way of introduction, thank you for the kind introduction, introducing my wife and I and my three kids. Just a little bit of extra information, my wife and I, we met in college. We graduated from Pensacola Christian College, and back in 2012 and got married then, and we have been together for almost 9 years, coming up in about 2 weeks' time. And how she has stuck it out with me this entire time, I believe, is the true miracle of our life story, because I have taken her around the world and back, and we have moved, I think, about 9 times so far. But the Lord has blessed us with many different opportunities, and one of our more exciting, you could say, adventures or interesting moves was when my wife and I went to do some missionary work on the island of Saipan. Saipan is this little island in the middle of the South Pacific. If you kind of know where Guam is on the globe, they just go a little bit north, and you're talking about 7 miles wide, 13 miles long, and that's literally the island itself. But we were there, and the fun part about it is it's still technically America. So we didn't need any special visas or anything like there. We just flew straight in, took 24 hours. That was the fastest we could get there. But we were there as teachers in a little Christian school. We were able to minister primarily to Chinese students. And we did that for about 2.5 years. And it was definitely an adventure, to say the least. We lived with, we had one storm come through and knock out power for a month straight for where we were at, 2 months for other places on the island. And then we lived in a house that had no hot water heater and all sorts of other fun experiences. So there's stories like that that when you come back to America, it makes you really appreciate for all the blessings that we have. Well, Sunday school this morning, we're going to be looking at the book of Haggai here. Definitely a minor prophet, not minor in message, but minor in the aspect of how short the book is. In fact, if you're looking at it, you can literally flip over. In my case, I'd flip over 2 pages, and that's it for the book. It's only 2 chapters long. But Haggai is a very powerful message and a very powerful, both of a reprimand and an encouragement for the people of Israel during the time the message was given. Now, the message, Haggai, this is one of the very few books where we can actually give a very accurate date for when this message was given. In verse 1, it says, in the second year of Darius the king, in the 6th month, in the 1st day of the month, came the word of the Lord by Haggai the prophet to the people. And with that introduction, this book was written on August 29th, 520 BC. And this is actually a very key pivotal time for the nation of Israel. Israel had gone through a lot of their history that we know, that we read of in the Old Testament. Abraham has come on and off the scenes He's come off and off the scenes, and Moses has come on and off the scene. David and Solomon, they're gone, they're past. And Israel is now actually trying to recover as a nation from the most devastating impact or punishment that had been bestowed upon them. Just several years prior, going back to 586, God sent the Babylonian nation to their city. The northern Israelites had already been taken away by the Assyrians. They've been off the scene for about 100 years at this point. But the nation of Judah had been holding on. And God said, now the time of your punishment is fulfilled. You are going to be taken out of the land. So he sent Nebuchadnezzar, and who came in and destroyed the nation of Israel, destroyed the city, destroyed the temple. And that's one of the key notes, especially for the book of Haggai, is that the temple was destroyed, and Israel was taken out of the land for 70 years. They had been taken away into what we call the Babylonian captivity, where during their time there, God was trying to cure them of their sin of idolatry. We note that before this, that they were kept falling into worshiping false gods, going after Baal, going after Molech, going after Ashtaroth. And their hearts were just always leaning towards the gods of the Canaanites. But during the time of the Babylonian captivity, they got their fill of the false gods. Everywhere they turned, they saw these Babylonians worshiping their false gods. And when they came back from their captivity, it's very interesting and encouraging to know that they actually were cured of their sin. After they came back, they didn't jump back to worshiping Baal. They didn't go back to worshiping Moloch, because during their captivity, they saw the end of that destruction. Well, when we come to the book of Haggai here, I know I'm giving a lot of history here, kind of building up where we're at today. With the book of Haggai, we are actually talking about a small group of people who finally came back from Babylon. Several hundreds of thousands to millions were taken out of the nation of Israel to Babylon, but only about 30 to 50,000 actually came back. And here are these people in the city of Jerusalem trying to rebuild the city and trying to get life back to what we could say normal, or as we can relate to today, the new normal after our pandemic, after everything has shut down. And the Israelites are experiencing several difficulties. They're encountering several problems. For one, they realize that they are a lot smaller in number than when they were as a nation when they were whole. Now they are a small group of people who are living in a land that is now filled with strangers, people who don't exactly like them because they see them as invaders. They see them as people who are now coming into the country and are now setting up their capital city again, rebuilding the walls. That was the book of Nehemiah. Nehemiah came in and said, all right, we need to rebuild our walls. And they did. They did that in record time. And they see these group of Israelites as foreigners, and they want them out. And as I'm describing them in the time back then, it sounds exactly like the propaganda we're hearing in the news about Israel today, where the Palestinians are viewing them as foreigners and they're wanting to thrust the Israelites back into the Mediterranean Sea and get them out of their land. So it's interesting that nothing new is under the sun. Well, because of the events of the people in the land looking at the Israelites as a bunch of foreigners, they decided to put the pressure upon the Israelites. Initially, they approached them and said, hey, you guys are trying to rebuild your temple. You're trying to rebuild and worship God again. How about you let us help you? How about we come in and we build the temple with you? The Israelites, their initial response was, no, you're not going to have any part of this. You're not going to join us in here in Jerusalem. You're not going to help us rebuild this temple. And the reason for that was because the Canaanites, all they were going to do was act like many nations in the world today, and that was to take God and put him on the shelf with all their other gods. And the Israelites realized you can't worship Jehovah and the gods of this world at the same time. So they said, we're going to keep our worship pure. You're not going to taint it. And because of that response, the people, they got offended, and they started sending letters back to Darius, back to the Medo-Persian Empire, and saying, hey, these people here, they shouldn't be here. They're rebellious. They rebuilt the walls. They're rebuilding this temple. This all needs to stop right now. Well, Darius gets the letter, and he says, well, we'll look into this, but till then, everything, put a hold on it. Stop building the temple. We're just going to not let you proceed forward. The Israelites got discouraged from that, and they stopped building the temple, and they then moved on into the book of Haggai here, where God had to raise up a messenger to tell the Israelites to get back to work. To work through the difficulty of the opposition that has been placed upon them. So continuing in the book of Haggai, in verse 1, continuing where the message of the Lord comes from Haggai the prophet unto Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, governor of Judah, and to Joshua, the son of Josedek, the high priest. Now, Haggai, the name itself means festive or festival. And apart from that, we know almost nothing about this individual. We assume that he was an older man who was preaching, and he was preaching along with the book next to him with the prophet Zechariah. And if you want a very interesting read, you can dive into some of the visions that the Lord gave to Zechariah. These two individuals were preaching at the exact same time to the exact same people here. But apart from just seeing Haggai being mentioned in the book of Ezra, we know very little to nothing about him. And the reason behind that, that we can pull a lesson from, is that God sometimes hides the messenger so that the message comes forth loud and clear. And that's what we're going to pull from this today, is that God hides the individual of Haggai to encourage us that no matter how big or how small, or no matter the opposition we have, we can do the work that he has set before us. And continuing in verse 2, we get God's message to these people. This is God using Haggai to encourage and to, in this case, to really pull out some strong vocabulary. "Thus speaketh the Lord of hosts, saying, This people say, the time is not come, the time that the Lord's house should be built." One thing to keep in mind is that by the time we get to 520 BC, when God is sending this message to the Israelites, this is 14 years after they stopped working on the temple. 14 years since the opposition first came up and said, "All right, you guys, since you're not going to play nice, we're going to play dirty." And then they got told to stop. So it's been a long period of time since they were told to cease. And that's why God's coming to them and saying, "Why are you saying now is not the time to get on with the work?" In essence, you can look at Israel, and Israel's command was to go back and to rebuild the temple. That was one of their main jobs and main tasks that they were put with. And yet, we find that they have become spiritually indifferent, that they are stepping back and saying, "You know, maybe not this year. Maybe next year we'll get onto that task. Or maybe the year after we'll get onto that task." Well, God is looking at these people and looking at what we could say is sin. He points out here in verse 2, he doesn't call them my people. Note how he calls them this people. Whenever we see that happening in the Bible, we should note that God has a covenant relationship with them. And when the people are following after God, God shows that personal, close relationship. But in this case, there's this separation happening between God and the Israelites. And it's because they're focusing on themselves. In fact, God goes on in verse 3, it says, "Then came the word of the Lord by Haggai the prophet, saying, Is it time for you, O ye, to dwell in your sealed houses, and this house lie waste? Now therefore, thus saith the Lord of hosts, consider your ways." It's very interesting that God is coming to the Israelites here, and he's really pointing out to them what they're doing and what their condition is. I've already noted that the people are spiritually indifferent. They've had 14 years of rest since they started the work of the Lord and stopped the work of the Lord. But what we find here is that God, in verse 4, he says that they are living in sealed houses. Sealed houses, that word sealed is also in 2 Chronicles 3:5, in Jeremiah 22:14, and in Ezekiel chapter 41. And every time that word is used, the word sealed is in reference to an ornate house. The Israelites, at this time, we can know that they're not living in tiny little shacks. They're not living in refugee camps. They've had 14 years to build their own homes, to set up their own houses, to get their businesses underway and prospering. And as a result of that, God is looking at them and saying, "Okay, you guys have set yourselves up. You have been so concerned about what you needed and what you wanted. Why are you then leaving my work undone? Why then are you leaving my temple wasted? Why is it still completely disassembled? Why is there no temple there?" And God goes on to say, "Consider your ways," meaning pay attention, perk up, look, open your ears, behold, as we would look at in the New Testament. He says, In verse 6, ye have sown much and bring in little. Ye eat, but ye have not enough. Ye drink, but ye are not filled with drink. Ye clothe you, but there is none warm. And he that earneth wages to put into a bag with holes. Now, one thing we need to remember is we're looking in the Old Testament where God has a covenant relationship with the Israelites. It is something different than what we're experiencing here in the New Testament as the New Testament church. We are living in the age of grace. They lived in the age of law. And part of the covenant that God made with the Israelites all the way back in the book of Deuteronomy is where God said, I will be your God. If you will be my people, I will be your God. If you will worship me, I will bless you. And during the Old Testament, we see times where Israelites were experiencing famine. Like I was just reading recently where David was ruling over the kingdom of Israel, and there was a famine that went on for 3 years. And then David, his reaction wasn't to say, oh, we need to do crop rotations. Oh, we need to buy grain from other lands. His reaction was realizing God said, if we are not being blessed materially, then something is wrong. And he went to the Lord, and he found out that there was still sin in Israel. In fact, sin from King Saul. Saul had persecuted and killed the Gibeonites, and that was a sin on the nation of Israel. So David had to take care of that in order to fix it. Well, God is using that covenant relationship, saying, hey, something is physically wrong around you guys, materially wrong. Consider, wake up. Take note that there is sin in the nation of Israel that needs to be taken care of. And he points out and says, you guys are planting, but you're bringing in very little. And we can find reference to every one of these things that God lists, that you're hungry and you eat, but you're hungry, thirsty, and even though you drink. Every one of those are listed in Deuteronomy chapter 28. And God's trying to point out to them what we know in Galatians chapter 6, verse 7 and 8 and 9. And that's the fact that what we sow, we will reap. And that principle is very true for us today, is that we have to consider ourselves, what are we reaping? What is coming into our lives right now? And is this a direct result of what we've been sowing? Is this a direct result of what we've been planting? Now, I do want to say, take care. Don't go to the extremes with that, because there are certain things that come into our life that are called trials. And I just want to say, take care not to look at a trial of life, something that is meant to test our mettle, to test our spiritual life, and see how strong are we in our faith and to grow us in our faith. Don't take those as looking at it as if we planted something wrong. Not every bad thing in our life is a result of something that we may or may not have done. So we have to take that both into consideration. For the Israelites, they were here. God is pointing and really showing to them that they have a problem and that they needed to consider their ways. God goes on to say in verse 7, thus saith the Lord of hosts, consider your ways. Go up to the mountain and bring wood, and build a house, and I will take pleasure in it. And I will be glorified, saith the Lord. Ye looked for much, and lo, it came to little. And when ye brought it home, I did blow upon it. Why? Saith the Lord of hosts, because of mine house that is laid waste. And ye run every man unto his own house. God is saying, the reason why you're not being blessed is because you're focused on yourselves. You are looking too much to building your own kingdom that you're neglecting the spiritual kingdom, or in this case, God's kingdom. Continuing in verse 10, therefore the heaven over you is stayed from dew. It's not going to be raining like it should. And the earth is stayed from her fruit. And I called for a drought upon the land and upon the mountains and upon the corn and upon the new wine and upon the oil and upon that which the ground bringeth forth, and upon men, and upon cattle, and upon all the labor of the hands. God is saying, I have brought this to you guys so that you will wake up. so that you'll open your eyes. Because evidently, after 14 years, they have become very, like we've said before, spiritually indifferent. They've gotten into that routine, or as we sometimes call the rut of life, where their eyes are just so narrow and focused on what's before them that they're neglecting what needed to happen, what needed to be done. Well, we come to a happy conclusion, which is something we can very rarely say when it comes to the nation of Israel, especially as we read through the Old Testament. It seemed like every time God talked to them, reminded them of what they've been doing, how they've been breaking the commandments, it always ended up with them receiving the punishment from God. But here, this is actually one of those very few rare times where we get a David moment, where they listen, they obey. In verse 12, it says, "Then Zerubbabel is the king during this time, the son of Shealtiel, and Joshua being the high priest, with all the remnants, with everybody who was left over, they obeyed the voice of the Lord their God and the words of Haggai the prophet, as the Lord their God had sent him, and the people did fear before the Lord. Then spake Haggai, the Lord's messenger, and the Lord's message unto the people, saying, I am with you, saith the Lord." So just to add a few comments here, the people obeyed. And that's always an exciting time whenever we read that, whenever we see that. And it encourages us in our lives, whenever we see ourselves walking away from the Lord. Well, when we obey, we see that the Lord opens up his blessings. And the first blessing that God gives to the nation of Israel, and I have it highlighted red here in my Bible just to pop it out, is where God says to the people, "I am with you." Obedience to God brings God's presence. Sin against God loses us the presence of God. Now, God will never leave us or forsake us, and he always knows where we are. He always knows what's happening in our life. But sin in our life breaks that fellowship. It makes it awkward for us to stand in his presence, very much like a little child. Let's say they went and broke something precious of their parents, and the parent does not yet know about it. Well, the child, when they are sitting there at the dinner table, do you think they're there confident and happy and giggling? No, they probably are sinking in their heart, and they're just dreading being in the presence of their parents. Well, the same is true when sin's in our life. Sin breaks that fellowship. It breaks that presence. And once we get that fixed, when we obey, when we confess with our mouth, and ask the Lord to forgive us, we get God's blessing, where he says, "I am with you." Well, it continues on in verse 14, "And the Lord stirred up the spirit of Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, governor of Judah, and the spirit of Joshua, the son of Joshedech, the high priest, and the spirit of all the remnant of the people. And they came and did work in the house of the Lord of hosts, their God, in the 420th day of the sixth month, in the second year of Darius the king." The people obeyed, God gave them the strength, and God blessed their work. Was the opposition still there? Yeah, those Canaanites, they never left. Were they still being a pain? Yes, they actually never stopped. In fact, the instances I'm describing here of where they came up against the nation of Israel, and that Israel said, "No, you can't come in, you can't build the temple," this is actually the beginning of the tension that we see continuing down to the day of Jesus Christ. Remember when Jesus was walking with the disciples going through the land of Samaria, and then the disciples are all looking at him and saying, "Okay, why are we going through Samaria? Why are we going to talk to the Samaritans? Why are we going to interact with them?" Well, that hatred began way back here. It began with these instances. And the Lord looks at that moment and says, "No, we're going to look past that. We're going to look at what they truly need." And that was repentance. Well, that is the book of Haggai, chapter 1. And I just want to open up. Are there any questions? I know. For Sunday school, I feel like I did it completely different in many different facets. I usually enjoy having a little bit more participation through the interactions and as we go along through the lesson. Instead, thank you guys for being very attentive and for listening for message number one. We'll be going for message number two here in a little bit. And if you want to do a little bit of an interesting study, I encourage you to look at chapter 2. Book of Haggai is broken up into four different messages, and we just looked at the first message. The second message is the first part of chapter 2, and it's really exciting. And just to do a very quick overcap of what it is, the people start doing the work, and then immediately, as soon as, like we're talking about, this first message was in August 29th. The second was on October 17th. Immediately, the people get discouraged. They're looking at the work. They're saying, this work is too small. It is dismal. It is tiny. This breaks our heart to do it. And God, he comes in and says, it doesn't matter about the size of the work. What matters is doing the work. So that, if you're ever discouraged, always look at Haggai chapter 2 and be encouraged that God doesn't care about the size. He cares about doing the work.
Where do you get those dates from, if you don't mind asking? Where do you get your dates from? You said these dates happened in August.
Yeah, so that's just... very good question. So right there, it's one of those things where we take the dates that are listed here and look at our history books. And what we're doing is we're now dating it not with the Jewish calendar, where we talk about, like, say, it was David's whatever year. We're actually looking at Darius. So we're looking, at this point, we look over with archaeology to the Medo-Persian Empire. We see from the history books of when they came and conquered. And we look and say, all right, this person was king from this time to this time. And well, during that date of when he was king, based on their scribes who wrote it down of their history, we can look over here and then do the calendar comparison. Good question. Any others? Yeah, technically mine doesn't either. I just have wide margin. But that's how they would have come up with the date, was by looking at saying, all right, here's where Darius is, this is when he reigned, and this is the date that we can pull from that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's exciting too, because it's one of the very few books that we can actually say, this is the date. The seventh month?
It's not the same as our calendar.
No, it would not be. I'm trying to remember what calendar they used, because I want to say ours was developed, I think it was by the Catholic, no, Pope. It was the Romans, that's right. So our calendar is with the Greco-Roman Empire. So the Romans is where we get our calendar from, and this predates the Romans. Like, I want to say... the Romans are still about 300 years or so before they really start coming on the scene and being a powerhouse. All right. Well, if you have any other questions, I'll be right here.